dims for a ceasefire in Gaza.
It would be tragic if weeks of intense diplomatic activity for peace in Gaza yield no ceasefire.
TikTok sues the United States government
to challenge a law that would force the sale of ByteDance's stake or face a ban.
And what is that sperm whale saying? Scientists think they've found a way to figure that out.
New research has found their system of communication is more sophisticated than once thought, and even has some similarities to human language. Like all marine mammals, sperm whales are very social animals. Their calls are an integral part of this.
Today is Wednesday, May 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition.
I'm Scott Walterman with Alexis Strope.
Israeli troops seized control of Gaza's vital Rafah border crossing on Tuesday in what the White House described as a limited operation as fears mount of a full-scale invasion of the southern city.
The War Cabinet unanimously decided Israel will continue its operation in Rafah in order to apply military pressure on Hamas to release our hostages and achieve all the war's objectives.
Israeli government spokesperson David Mentzer. Israeli jets have carried out repeated strikes on eastern Rafah, where more than 1 million Palestinians displaced by the seven-month war have been sheltering, Hamas official Osama Hamdan. He's saying if the aggression continues, there will be no ceasefire because Israelis are the ones attacking and shooting.
So let's go deeper. Joining us now to talk about this is James Gelvin. He's a professor in the Department of History at the University of California, Los Angeles, and has written extensively on the history of the modern Middle East. So yesterday we had this roller coaster. Hamas accepts, Israel says not so fast. They both say we're coming back to the table. And then today, with an increased military presence in Rafah at the gate and also on the outskirts of Rafah, now Hamas is saying, well, you know, we can't have a ceasefire if they're going to be aggressive because we're going to have to respond. And it looks like yesterday's hope is dashed. Or am I wrong?
One of the problems that we have is that there are just too many moving parts. We don't know what's up. We don't know what the principals are up to, principals including the United States, by the way, which is encouraging the ceasefire talks. We don't know whether the principals are serious, whether this is a bargaining ploy for the principals, whether it's a stall for time. I mean, Israel, of course, wants to reposition. Hamas wants to prepare, whether this might be a ruse for domestic political consumption. One thing overall is that Israel does not want a permanent ceasefire. Netanyahu is determined to destroy Hamas, which is a particularly impossible undertaking. His government will collapse if he backs away from that goal. And if his government collapses, he goes to jail. Hamas, on the other hand, is not prepared for a part-time ceasefire. What it wants is a long-term ceasefire or permanent ceasefire, and they might be in a position to be able to negotiate towards that end. The Americans are at this point pushing for some sort of settlement, some sort of agreement, and Hamas is trying to show that there's daylight between the Israelis and the Americans. So there's just a ton of moving parts in this whole equation, and it gets very, very difficult to predict exactly what's going to happen.
I had a guest offer the opinion that the only two that matter at the table are Israel and Hamas, and what they need more than anything is the appearance of victory.
I would very much agree with that. I think that what you have is two very willful groups here, the Israeli government on the one hand, Hamas on the other hand. Neither is prepared to back down. The chances of a compromise are not very good, particularly since the Israelis have got maximalist demands and Hamas also has maximalist demands. So it looks very, very difficult to see how this thing is going to work out. The problem with the Israelis is that the government itself is divided and the population is divided. between those who want to prioritize the hostages and those who want to prioritize destroying Hamas. So we're not quite sure the way it's going to end up. It looks like the destruction of Hamas is more important to the Israeli government than the recovery of the hostages.
The polling suggests that the majority of the Israelis, there is a huge faction that wants the ceasefire deal to get the hostages back. But I think the majority in the most recent polling shows that they want to destroy Hamas. And likewise, in Gaza, there's new polling that shows people very unhappy with Hamas because they've gone through all this misery and have nothing to show for it, according to the polling. Are we at a point now where these two government entities are really acting on their own behalf rather than their populations?
That appears to be the case. It appears to be the case that the Israeli government wants to ensure that it can stay in power, and that Netanyahu wants to make sure that he's not going to go to jail, which means that he has to stay in power, no matter what the Israeli population wants. It also demonstrates the fact that Hamas itself wants to continue along the path that it started, which was intended to, from the very beginning, of burnishing his credentials as a legitimate spokesman of the Palestinian cause, with getting the Palestine issue back on the front burner of international politics, and who now is talking about the Saudi-Israeli deal. That was the most important focus of attention before October 7th.
If you had to make a bet or a guess, is this going to turn short time, or are we in for a longer road to get to ceasefire?
I think what's going to happen is that the ceasefire is probably not going to occur in the form that we are looking at right now. That the ultimate goal, I think, or the ultimate ending of this whole crisis is going to be Israel will declare victory and will withdraw. It's what pundits said that the United States should do in Vietnam. There's no way that they're going to be able to destroy Hamas. But the plan that they put forward for post-war developments in Gaza is unworkable. It'll never happen.
Hmm. Thank you so very much for the time.
You're welcome.
Professor James Gelvin from UCLA.
In remarks honoring the 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust, U.S. President Joe Biden on Tuesday warned that the threat of anti-Semitism is growing.
This hatred continues to lie deep in the hearts of too many people in the world and requires our continued vigilance and outspokenness. That hatred was brought to life on October 7th in 2023.
In his keynote address for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum's annual national commemoration of the Days of Remembrance, Biden aimed to cool a divided and divisive U.S. debate about Jewish security, Zionism, free speech, and support for Israel. The U.S. has the largest Jewish population after Israel.
Here we are, not 75 years later, but just 7.5 months later, and people are already forgetting, that Hamas unleashed this terror. It was Hamas that brutalized Israelis. It was Hamas who took and continues to hold hostages. I have not forgotten, nor have you, and we will not forget.
Reports of an Israeli attack in Gaza City early Wednesday morning, an Israeli airstrike killed at least 7 people and wounded several others, according to a local hospital. Witnesses on Wednesday are also reporting strikes in the Strip, particularly around Rafah.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Reuters is reporting that AstraZeneca is withdrawing its COVID-19 vaccine worldwide months after admitting a rare side effect.
President Vladimir Putin began his fifth term Tuesday at a glittering Kremlin inauguration. That gives him another 6 years as leader of Russia.
TikTok and its Chinese parent company ByteDance are suing the U.S. over a law that would ban the popular app, unless it's sold to another company. If TikTok loses, it says it'll be forced to shut down next year.
In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump are both using artificial intelligence to attract voters. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns reports on machine learning in this U.S. election.
For political campaigns looking to best target the most voters most economically, generative artificial intelligence is the biggest change in politics.
The models are getting better very rapidly. It feels like every week there's some new model which is significantly better than a previous model.
Those models are powerful tools for campaigns at the national level and at the local level, says political strategist Betsy Hoover.
Think about the campaign that does not have digital staff at all, and therefore really doesn't have a digital content program. Like, generative AI allows them to have one, and a pretty robust one if they want to. Or think about a candidate who's running against a well-funded incumbent. AI has a huge role to play in that campaign.
Hoover's firm invests in developing technology for Democratic Party and left-leaning causes. She says the key to machine learning in politics is, quote, doing it the right way.
I don't really know exactly what every Republican campaign would say their standards are, but I do know that Democrats have a high standard for how we're going to use this new technology. And so I'm not really worried about falling behind if it is not ethical and responsible use of AI.
In 2016, the Trump campaign used unprecedented social media advertising with hyper-personalized messages, working with the British data mining firm Cambridge Analytica to directly target individual voters in swing states. Brad Parsale was that campaign's senior advisor for data and digital operations. His firm Campaign Nucleus powers the 2024 Trump website. Parsale told a Conservative Freedom Fest conference earlier this year that artificial intelligence can analyze voter data to create mass personalized text and email ads and deploy paid workers to pick up absentee ballots.
In a couple of years, you're going to be able to have this running for office on your cell phone, an AI-driven press release machine, write your campaign emails, fundraising tech, everything right on your cell phone, all built for you.
It's not just the campaigns. Polling by the American Press Institute and the Associated Press show 42% of American voters worry that news outlets will use generative artificial intelligence to create stories during this campaign. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Chinese President Xi Jinping wrapped up his two-day visit to France Tuesday. It's his first trip to Europe in 5 years. As Henry Ridgewell reports, China and Europe are seeking to mend ties, but face major obstacles, including trade disputes and Beijing's support for Russia.
French President Emmanuel Macron invited his Chinese counterpart high into the Pyrenees Mountains Tuesday, the home region of the French leader's grandmother. It was Xi Jinping's first visit to Europe in 5 years, and since then, relations have soured. Europe accuses Beijing of subsidizing industries that are undercutting its own companies in areas like electric vehicles.
It's a desire for mutual respect and understanding, and a desire to continue to open up trade, but to ensure that it is fully fair at all times, whether in terms of tariffs, aid, or access to markets.
Xi made no immediate concessions, says analyst Steve Sang.
Xi Jinping does not feel that China has an overcapacity issue, and he feels that the European position on Chinese EV, for example, is unreasonable. But then, of course, he is also trying to engage with the French and potentially having a leading Chinese car manufacturer setting up facilities in France.
Western nations accused China of aiding Russia's invasion of Ukraine through increased trade and the sale of dual-use goods that can be used to make weapons. President Xi rejected those accusations.
China is neither the creator of the crisis nor a party a participant of the war. However, we didn't just watch the fire burning across the river, but have been playing an active role in achieving peace.
That is demonstrably false, and European leaders must take a tougher line, says analyst Igor Mehheim-Ehr.
What they really failed at is spelling out to Xi Jinping what will be the cost of China supporting Russia's war of aggression, which it clearly is. I mean, if it wasn't, we wouldn't already have four Chinese companies on the EU sanction list. And, you know, the circumventions are much broader than that. If we look at exports, Chinese exports to Russia have increased year on year by about 45%.
EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen urged Beijing to use all its influence on Russia.
We agree that Europe and China have a shared interest in peace and security.
Europe should be more realistic about Beijing's ambitions, says analyst Mehheim-Ehr.
Wherever I look, from Africa to South China Sea to Ukraine, China is playing a destructive role. And I do not see common areas of interest in these matters.
She arrived Tuesday evening in Serbia, a key Balkan partner in Beijing's Belt and Road investment program. Later this week, she heads to Hungary, his closest European ally, and a longtime thorn in the side of EU unity on Russia and China policy. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman, along with Alexis Stroh.
Conflict and climate change remain the most significant factors driving global displacement.
Now, climate change is driving more new displacement than ever before, but the biggest problem is still conflict. We see that here in Bangladesh, where nearly a million Rohingya people have been forced to flee their homes because of ongoing conflict in their home country.
International Organization for Migration Director General Amy Pope in Dhaka on Tuesday at an event launching the World Migration Report 2024.
In Myanmar, the junta and the resistance have a limited window to make gains or hold their ground as monsoon clouds begin rolling across the country around early June. The rain particularly hampers the government military by taking away the advantage of its air power.
We know more about a U.S. soldier arrested in Russia. Apparently, he traveled there while on leave, despite a prohibition by the Department of Defense and State Department.
Staff Sergeant Gordon C. Black enlisted in the U.S. Army as an infantryman and was enlisted as an infantryman in 2008. He was most recently assigned to 8th Army, U.S. Forces Korea at Camp Humphreys in the Republic of South Korea. On April 10th, Black outprocessed from 8th Army and signed out on permanent change of station to leave en route to Texas. However, instead of returning to the U.S., Black flew from Korea through China and then to Vladivostok, Russia, for personal reasons.
Pentagon spokesperson Sabrina Singh, who says any leave to Russia is strictly prohibited by both the U.S. Department of Defense and the U.S. State Department.
And finally, we've known for a long time that sea mammals talk to each other. Dolphins and whales can be heard on sonar, singing and making other noises in patterns that resemble speech. Now, a new analysis of years of vocalization by sperm whales in the Eastern Caribbean has found that their system of communication is more sophisticated than previously known. Here's Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino with more on whale speech.
This is what it sounds like when sperm whales communicate. Those bursts of clicking noises are called codas. It sounds a bit like Morse code. New research has found their system of communication is more sophisticated than once thought, and even has some similarities to human language. Using traditional statistical analysis and artificial intelligence, researchers examined calls made by about 60 whales. They found the vocalizations exhibit a complex internal structure and seemingly even a phonetic alphabet. Researchers also identified similarities to aspects of other animal communication systems, including those used by humans.
So whales don't produce arbitrary sequences of clicks. They instead tend to produce them in one of a relatively limited set of fixed patterns.
MIT professor Jacob Andreas is one of the researchers working on Project SETI.
So on one hand, you have pictographic systems like ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, where every word is associated with a different kind of unique picture, and there aren't actually relationships between them. And on the other hand, you have alphabetic systems like English, where there's a much smaller set of pieces that we call letters that combine to produce all the different words that we see written down. And so one way of thinking about what we're doing in this new paper is showing that sperm whale codas are more like an alphabetic system than a pictographic system, which was kind of the picture that we had before. That all of these different codas that we see are actually built by combining a comparatively simple set of smaller pieces.
Sperm whales, which can reach about 60 feet long and are the largest of the toothed whales, also have the largest brain of any animal. But what exactly are the whales talking about? MIT's Andreas says they're still trying to figure that part out.
And so a big part of the larger Project SETI effort here is to actually get that behavioral data paired with the communication data in order to answer these deeper questions about what it is that the whales are saying.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman with Alexis Strope.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Freedom and prosperity are two of the crucial elements to success, said U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, Brian Nichols.
And if you don't have political freedom, if you don't have economic freedom, if you don't feel that you and your family can prosper, that's going to lead to things like irregular migration, crime, gang activity, lack of faith in democratic institutions. Those are all things that we want to avoid.
The countries that suffer from serious democratic challenges, criminal activity, or lack of economic opportunity are generating the largest number of migrants, said Assistant Secretary Nichols.
The leading generator of irregular migrants in our region is Venezuela, and there are probably 8 million Venezuelan migrants around our hemisphere, many of them in the frontline states like Colombia, Ecuador, and Brazil, but also as far away as Argentina and Chile, or as far north as the United States and Canada. So that obviously is a reflection of the lack of hope, lack of opportunity, and a lack of democratic space that the populace has there.
Nicaragua and Haiti, as well as Mexico and northern Central America, are also producing significant numbers of migrants. Assistant Secretary Nichols noted that the 2022 Los Angeles Declaration on Migration Protection, a document that brought together 20 countries from the region to promote safe, legal migration and to stop irregular migration, has made significant progress.
It brings together new pathways for people to migrate legally, but also provides training for border officials so that they can control irregular migration, information sharing among countries so they can help dismantle the networks of migrant smugglers and human traffickers that prey on the needs of those who wish to migrate. It also helps countries work out new facilities to stabilize migrant populations where they are. In the United States, as well as many other countries in the region, actually need labor in certain sectors. So facilitating migrants to work in certain areas legally is something that can be quite positive.
Promotion of democratic freedoms and economic prosperity are central to our efforts, said Assistant Secretary Nichols, noting that these are the same goals enshrined in the founding documents of the Western Hemisphere, including the Charter of the Organization of American States and the Inter-American Democratic Charter.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.